Okay, next case for argument, Zingerman versus Freeman Decorating, Mr. Pinzer.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Pinzer. I represent the plaintiff appellant. Judges and bar associations have repeatedly been calling for more civility in court proceedings and for lawyers to work together to resolve discovery disputes. Yet when our plaintiff's attorney acted in a civil manner by seeking cooperation, the defendant used plaintiff's olive branch as a weapon, and the trial court penalized plaintiff for attempting to resolve such a discovery dispute. The defendant stifled and obstructed the discovery process by refusing to produce the witnesses for depositions and nevertheless, the parties were able to reach a stage of a settlement negotiation and defer depositions by both parties for two weeks prior to the end of discovery. And the defendant has not even responded to plaintiff's contention of the obstruction of the discovery process in its brief, but merely relies upon the trial court's arbitrary decision. The reason the depositions did not take place was not just because the plaintiff's counsel's mother had died 2 days before the depositions. The real reason was the defendant had not produced the deponents for deposition back in several months earlier when they were noticed. The depositions were delayed to reach a settlement negotiation. By denying the extension of discovery, which would have only extended discovery by 9 days, the court is in effect not only condoning defendant's obstructive conduct, but in effect encouraging it. Why would any attorney ever continue a deposition in the future knowing that the court will use it as a penalty against them? It is sending the wrong message to lawyers when we're constantly under attack by the media and the public, and rightfully so, because lawyers have become uncivil. By trying to be civil, we're being paralyzed. I suggest the proper relief is either to remand to the trial court on this issue to extend discovery, or to give the plaintiff his day in court, or bar the witnesses, which would be similar to a motion in limine. The death of the plaintiff's counsel's mother, my associate's mother, immediately prior to the close of discovery was material change in circumstances.
But there were other lawyers involved in the case. Why was the associate so essential?
There were 5 depositions over 2 days. This was only several days before I was the other attorney, and I was not fully prepared, although I was lead counsel in the case, admittedly. I was not fully prepared to take the depositions. I had other conflicts in other cases, but that's the real reason, is I just wasn't prepared. It was only several days before, and as in an effort to reach cooperation, I offered to have the depositions, which defendant refused to submit the deponents, in any place other than Chicago. And even though they were properly before the they were properly noticed for Cook County, Illinois, and properly noticed and to appear either in Lake County, and then I offered to do it in the northern part of Cook County, and an agreement was reached. After the agreement was reached, the defendant's counsel then reneged on that agreement. The trial court's refusal to grant a continuance to conduct the necessary and limited discovery was an abuse of discretion, resulting in actual and substantial prejudice to the plaintiff. The Giles set forth a reasonable and clear standard, as I set forth in our brief. The trial court's denial of the party's agreed motion was arbitrary. Judge Corey's refusal to grant the extension placed a much higher weight on the court's own convenience and the defendant's request for additional time to file dispositive motions. There would have been no delay in the court's schedule to a delay in the defendant having the deposition transcript to present their own dispositive motion. However, all of the deponents to be deposed were under the direct control of the defendant, and the defendant certainly knew what their testimony would be. They were employees of the defendant company. While the trial court suggested that an extensive discovery would have disrupted this court schedule, the discovery process actually had no effect whatsoever on the trial court schedule. The defendant, in effect, would not have been harmed. There is a sense of arrogance and disdain by the trial courts, as the trial court is demonstrated by Judge Cord's comments in his memorandum opinion and order, where on page 3 he states sarcastically, "This is not a complicated," and I quote this, "This is not a complicated case. It's employment discrimination, not rocket science." If this area was so crystal clear and uncomplicated, why does the Supreme Court keep accepting so many cases in this area of law? Why is this very court often called to rule in this area of law? It is. Perhaps it's not rocket science, but it is equivalent for lawyers. Judge Cord goes on to state what witnesses' testimonies will be on pages 3 and 4 of his memorandum of opinion. Lawsuits are sort of like sport events in a way. If we knew everything that would happen in a trial court, we would not have to have the trial, just like you would not have to have the sports event. However, the trial court, in this case, crowned a winner without allowing the plaintiff even the chance to ever get the ball. Most important, the defendant selectively used the testimony of 5 witnesses through affidavits when the plaintiff was unable to elicit any testimony through deposition because the court denied our right to take the deposition. While Judge Cord said he did not approve of the, and I quote, defendant's unilateral cancellation of the agreement to conduct depositions after the discovery deadline, end of quote, the trial court is in effect condoning such conduct. And the trial court is in effect encouraging such, as the court referred to it, unilateral action.
You suggest that you noticed these depositions and they wouldn't cooperate or something? Is this when you wanted to depose them in your office or some other place other than theirs? Is that the problem?
It wasn't convenient for defendant's counsel.
Okay. And then you also, I think they say that one of the reasons that you went to the last minute is because there is some attempt to have a global settlement with the workers' comp along with this case.
Correct. There was a major meeting of all parties 14 days before discovery closed, and the depositions were deferred till then.
So that's what crammed it to the last minute, I guess.
Yes. There were only 5 months for the... Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
that. But that was Judge Cord's problem. He said, well, you know, why should shove it all the way to the end, and here you are lead counsel, and it's your associate whose mother died, and you still had 5 or 6 days to prepare for the death.
No, I had 2 days, Your Honor.
Was it only 2 days?
Okay. Well, yeah. And I did have other conflicts, but I don't make that as an excuse, Your Honor. I suggest that it would not have caused any hardship to the court or the defendant to have granted an additional 9 days. The trial court recognized both parties are in error. Judge Cord's very memorandum of opinion, and I quote, "Both parties are in error," close quote. But the judge, the court, only punished the plaintiff and condoned the activity of the defendant, and in effect sends the message, don't cooperate on discovery, don't try and resolve discovery dispute, take your other party to the brink of the end of the case and then renege on your promises. Is this the message we want to carry out to the public? I don't think this court wants to, and I don't think that's what legal community wants to do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Fenger. Ms. Baker?
May I please the court? What really happened in this case is that plaintiff's counsel gambled on being able to take 5 or 6 depositions in the last 2 days in a nearly 5-month discovery period. when faced with an unexpected event, the unfortunate death of Ms. Bryan's mother 5 days before the deposition date, they found it difficult or inconvenient to proceed as scheduled. Because of this and the delay in seeking an extension of time from the trial court after that event, the discovery period expired without plaintiffs having taken any depositions and also without having filed a motion for any relief on that ground. The first time that plaintiffs raised their objections to anything that happened during the discovery period was in their response to our motion for summary judgment. They never filed any motion to compel any written discovery responses or even communicated at all with defendant's counsel regarding any perceived problem with answers to interrogatories or Rule 26 disclosures. The plaintiff complained to the trial court in the response to the motion for summary judgment that he lacked sufficient information on the subjects on which the defendant's witnesses might testify. None of the individuals listed by defendant were unknown to the plaintiff. The trial court decided there was not one iota of prejudice to the plaintiff because the witnesses named were all supervisors and the union steward of the plaintiff when he was employed by defendant. The plaintiff did not offer any argument to the trial court regarding its denial of the party's agreed motion to extend discovery at the time that it was heard in court, nor did the plaintiff file a motion to reconsider in the trial court. So the trial court was really forced to respond to these discovery issues for the first time when raised in plaintiff's response to the motion for summary judgment. Your Honor, discovery decisions are reviewable only for abuse of discretion by the trial court, and the Giles versus United Airlines case sets out various reasons that this might occur. The factors considered might be whether the record contains evidence upon which the court could have rationally based its decision. If the decision is based on an erroneous conclusion of law, the decision is based on a clearly erroneous factual finding, the decision clearly appears arbitrary, and if any of those exist, then there also must be a showing of actual and substantial prejudice to the plaintiff. The decision to grant or deny a continuance is within the sound discretion of the trial court, and the plaintiff has relied in his briefing primarily on the claimed existence of changed circumstances to which the plaintiff's counsel could not reasonably have been expected to adjust without an extension of time. But the case of Hartwig versus Canner in this circuit made it clear that where a litigant has failed to take advantage of opportunities to conduct discovery, a denial of additional time for discovery will be withheld. The plaintiff relies primarily on a Fifth Circuit case.
Now, in his reply brief, Mr. Pinder says that he had originally planned to take depositions more than a month before the close of discovery. Did you have any comment on that?
That's true, Your Honor. Originally, the depositions were noticed for sometime in March, I believe the middle of March. Those were postponed solely on the initiative of plaintiff. At no time did defendant ever refuse to produce its witnesses for depositions. In fact, it was the hope of the plaintiff that a global settlement could be worked out in this case, and he preferred to wait until after a settlement conference could be held between all counsel and the parties in order to take depositions. And that's what occurred. That's why the depositions were rescheduled by the plaintiff for the last 2 days of the discovery period. In addition, the issue raised by plaintiff regarding the location of the depositions, there were some misstatements made by plaintiff's counsel. It's true that defense counsel objected to producing approximately six witnesses at the Long Grove, Illinois offices of plaintiff's counsel. That's because the depositions were anticipated to be very brief, These were people who would be working during those days, all at defendant's location in the city of Chicago on the south side, and each would need to necessarily drive separately to Long Grove and back and miss at least a half day of work just for the transportation alone. For the convenience and practicality, we wanted the depositions to take place in the city of Chicago at a more central location. In fact, although plaintiff's counsel objected to that position, he never sought to compel the depositions at any other location. And in fact, it's not even relevant to complain of that now since the depositions were never actually taken.
Were those earlier noticed depositions to be your office or his?
They were originally noticed to be at the Long Grove office of plaintiff's counsel.
But you objected to that, right?
We objected to that.
And
we,
then when the ones that were scheduled and then canceled in order to get to this global negotiation, where were those going to be?
The original notice was that the depositions would take place at plaintiff's counsel's office.
Okay, it's the same notice.
Same location was specified. At the time that we received the initial notice, I had a conversation, telephone conversation with Ms. Bryan in which I explained our position. She did not object or state that they would insist that the depositions take place in Long Grove. Later, in the last week of April, when the scheduling problems came to a head because of the death of Ms. Bryan's mother, we had another conversation with Mr. Pinzer in which he strongly stated that he wanted the depositions to take place in Long Grove, but in fact did not insist, agreed that they would take place in our offices, and never did take this issue to the trial court to resolve. In fact,
where is Long Grove? Is that far away?
Long Grove is actually outside of Cook County, and it's on the north, in the northwest suburban area of the Chicago area.
Why didn't you want to go there?
It was not for the inconvenience to counsel. It was for the inconvenience of the deponents. There were to have been numerous, very brief depositions over the course of 2 days. Each deponent would have had to travel separately
they were
there
all
and
in
back.
Chicago,
they were all going to be
Chicago.
Driving from their workplace
work
in Chicago. So it made more sense. In fact, we offered to accommodate plaintiff's counsel in any way that we could at our offices, where we would provide him with an office space and facilitate the depositions in any way possible. It was more practical for plaintiff's counsel to travel with the very few documents that were relevant in this case to our offices for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is that it? Or
Your Honor, I just want to point out a couple of other factual inconsistencies. In the reply brief by the plaintiff's counsel, plaintiff's counsel states that they produced two witnesses at the offices of defendant's attorneys. In fact, that's not the case. Plaintiff was produced for deposition at our offices upon our notice back in February, months before the period ran out. And the only other deposition that occurred was that of a non-party witness who was not produced by plaintiff but appeared by deposition by defendant. And I would be glad to answer any questions Your Honors have.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Baker. Mr. Pinzer, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I did not hear, Your Honor.
You have a minute.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Why is it always easier for a suburban lawyer, which is 36 miles away from the loop?
Well, no, she explained. There were a bunch of these people in New York, in Chicago, and they didn't want to dash out to Long Grove. You could come in and depose them, and so the aggregate travel time would be minimized, one of you and several of them.
Okay, but that's
reasonable. What's wrong with that?
Your Honor, there's a tendency of Chicago lawyers to always ask suburban lawyers, and
that's a separate point. Okay. The point is the deponents. There's one of you, and there or Ms. Bryan or what have you, and there are several deponents. So the total travel time is minimized if you come to Chicago rather than their traipsing out to Long Grove.
And Your Honor is correct, and that is why we did agree to take depositions. And ultimately, we agreed to take depositions in Chicago, and a defendant reneged on that agreement as well.
What about these depositions that were scheduled for more than a month before the end of discovery?
Right. The conference being.
What happened to those?
Those were the depositions at issue right now. The other two depositions, the two depositions of the plaintiff and the plaintiff's witness, were taken, and it was not the unilateral action of the plaintiff to defer the depositions. In fact, we wanted to proceed with the depositions. It was the defense said, let's not spend the settlement money on depositions. Let's go to the settlement meeting. We agreed to that in the interest of cooperation because we don't want to blow all the settlement money on discovery. The defendant's settlement money, and was at their request, not at our request, to continue the depositions. So we were willing to go to Chicago. We wanted to proceed with the depositions, but the defendant wanted to use that money towards settlement, and we were obliged to that because we wanted to settle the case, which is what the court also wanted us to do, ultimately. Though it was a joint agreement. There was also, and Smith's wife, which is cited in my brief, talks about a change in circumstances, and that decision cited by NIPSO, by this very court, the Seventh Circuit, by analogy, sick lawyers or grieving lawyers, other lawyers in the office, not as familiar, not prepared to take the proceed. The court found that it was arbitrary not to give a continuance. This is the same situation here. There was substantial prejudice. Defendant suggests that there was no substantial prejudice raised. It is. The very fact that we were not able to depose defendant's witnesses left us bare. We couldn't counter any of their affidavits.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, both counsel. Last case for